This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, you've probably heard of the Boston Celtics or Golden State Warriors playing the NBA Finals this week. But how about the Oshkosh All-Stars? We'll talk with a basketball historian about the origins of the pro game here in the Midwest. Now, new gun legislation is working its way through Congress with some optimism from Democrats and Republicans that they might be able to find common ground. The bills come as President Biden called for a series of new regulations in a primetime speech last week.
We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And if we can't ban assault weapons, then we should raise the age to purchase them from 18 to 21, strengthen background checks, enact safe storage law and red flag laws, repeal the immunity that protects gun manufacturers from liability, address the mental health crisis, deepening the trauma of gun violence and as a consequence of that violence.
The bill's up for debate in the House, and the negotiations in the Senate don't include all of Biden's proposals, but could mark a significant step in federal firearm regulations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want Congress to take up any or all of those measures President Biden was calling for? What kind of regulations, if any, would you support? If you're opposed to new gun laws, how would you like Congress to respond to a recent mass shootings and other episodes of gun violence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Jacob Charles is Executive Director of the Center for Firearms Law at Duke University. Jake, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we heard from the president there. Democrats in the House are advancing some legislation, but the big funnel is the U.S. Senate. What are you watching for as some Republican and Democratic senators seem to be conversing with the idea that they might pass something?
Right. And so this is something that we saw, especially in the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting in 2012, where it looked like there was a lot of bipartisan activity and a lot of support, especially for a background check bill that would have expanded the federal requirement for background checks to a lot of different private sales. Obviously, in 2012, that bipartisan coalition fell apart and there was not ultimately legislation passed. This time, it's hard to say at this point for me as a political insider, but as a legal scholar looking in from the outside, whether it's more like 2012 and those initial stages where it looks like there's going to be some gun laws enacted, or if it's different and the Senate can actually agree on something and pass legislation. There are also this time around some new proposals in the mix that weren't discussed or weren't as discussed as seriously in 2012. One of those being red flag laws that now 19 states in the District of Columbia have these laws, and Congress is considering legislation to incentivize more states to take it up.
Let's tackle that point now, the idea of not a federal red flag law, but a federal effort to encourage states to do that. And people are pointing toward Florida, a Republican-controlled state for quite a while now after the Parkland shooting, putting this red flag law in place. When we say red flag laws, what do we mean? What does that look like in most implementations?
Right. So what red flag laws are they are a civil restraining order that is modeled off of domestic violence restraining orders. And so these are non-criminal proceedings. They are laws that allow law enforcement, sometimes family or household members. Some laws allow other groups of people to go into court and tell a judge this person is exhibiting signs and behaviors in conduct that is showing them to be an imminent risk of harm to themselves or others. If the judge is then satisfied that the standard is met, that this person is an imminent risk of harm to themselves or others, the judge can issue an order that temporarily deprives the person from possessing firearms for a finite period of time. There is an initial emergency order that can be issued in most laws that lasts usually 2 weeks or less. And then there's a longer order that can be issued after a full hearing that sometimes lasts up to about a year. But these are temporary orders and they're designed for these periods of crisis where somebody's going to be a threat to themselves or others.
The argument against red flag laws when it comes up is that it doesn't allow sufficient due process for the person who's having guns removed from their premises. From a legal standpoint, what do you think of that argument?
Right. So from a legal standpoint, I think first, it's surprising to some to think that the kind of go-to counterargument wouldn't be the Second Amendment, but it's this due process concern. And one reason for that is that courts have recognized that legislatures have the power to take away the weapons from someone who's considered dangerous under the Second Amendment. And so the due process concerns are focused, as the name suggests, on the process, not on the actual substance of the law, not on the fact that it's removing firearms, but on what process you get before those arms can be removed. And so from a constitutional perspective, there are many areas of law where the Supreme Court has said emergency action is necessary to protect the public health and safety, and it's okay for those hearings to be held on a temporary emergency basis and then later have a full hearing at which the person can contest that evidence. So it happens in if there are, you know, credible allegations of child abuse, a child can be removed from the custody of their parents even before the parent has a full opportunity to go to a hearing and contest the evidence against them. And these kind of situations are specifically the kinds where imminent action is necessary to reduce the risk of catastrophic harm. So the court has said on many occasions that this kind of situation is perfectly consistent with due process. And so from a constitutional perspective, just the fact that there are these emergency orders possible is not a grounds to think that they violate the due process clause. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't concerns that states should be really cognizant of when they're thinking about these laws. They should be thinking about what time period these laws are going to be in effect for, what standard of proof the person should have to prove before the guns can be removed, what group of people can go into court and ask for a petition, whether there are statutory penalties for somebody who uses this process maliciously or abuses it, although we haven't seen that in the states that have enacted these laws. So there are certainly issues for states and the federal government to be concerned about, but it's just inaccurate under existing constitutional law to say that the structure of these red flag laws is violating due process.
Jake Charles is with us from the Center for Firearms Law at Duke University, looking at ideas on the table in the Congress, especially in the Senate, when it comes to gun reforms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there things you'd like to see pass? Are you things you're worried about passing? Call 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to express my opinion and get your reaction. I believe that our rights in the Constitution require us to take some responsibility. So every time I see people talk about, I have a right to do this, I have a right to do that, we also have a responsibility as citizens to be, intelligent in exercising our rights. So my opinion is, I believe we have a right to bear arms, but we have a responsibility to learn how to operate that weapon safely. And I actually support the laws where you are 21 years old before you can own something like that. In fact, I think 21 should be a federal law for everything, voting, driving, everything, because then we know that's the age of adulthood. But I'm not going to change everything. It's just my opinion that we need maturity when it comes to exercising our rights. Thank
Jeff,
you.
Thanks a lot for the call. And Jake, Jeff points toward another idea being bounced around and getting some approval for, including from Senator Manchin in West Virginia, a Democrat who's sometimes skeptical about changes in gun laws, changing the age for certain categories of firearms, the minimum age from 18 to 21. I've seen people say semi-automatic weapons or semi-automatic rifles. I think there's a couple different ideas bouncing around there. Again, people saying, well, wait a minute, why can you take away rights for that 3 years of somebody's life? What are your thoughts on the legality of that kind of change, the minimum age for ownership of certain kind of guns?
Right. And so one of the things that's interesting about it is you noted that Florida enacted these red flag laws after the Parkland shooting. It also raised the age for rifle purchases up to 21 as well. So another instance of a red state taking these actions in response to a mass shooting that are now getting picked up on the national level. A federal judge did uphold Florida's law against a Second Amendment challenge. It's now on appeal in the Federal Court of Appeals governing Florida. But a similar California law that bars those who are 18 to 20 years old from purchasing certain semi-automatic firearms and long guns in particular. That law, a federal appeals court in California struck down just a few weeks ago as violating the Second Amendment. I think that law is, or that opinion is not likely to stand. It's probably going to get reversed by the en banc, the full Ninth Circuit. But there's certainly a difference of opinion right now about what the Second Amendment allowed states to do with age restrictions. Under existing federal law, federal licensed dealers, gun dealers, they can't sell handguns to those who are under 21 years of age. And some of the proposals are to raise that age requirement for dealers up to 21 for rifles and shotguns, just like it is for handguns. I've seen those proposals discussed. And I think there's contested history there. There's kind of contested constitutional understandings based on the fact that we have different courts going in different directions. But I think it's certainly one of the things that has been getting a lot of attention, as we saw recent mass shooting perpetrators who were under 21 years old, and they were able to go into a licensed gun dealer and purchase their rifles legally.
We're talking about the latest gun legislation being debated and negotiated in Congress. Jake Charles is with us, executive director of Duke University's Center for Firearms Law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of some of the changes on the table? Expanding background checks, changing age limits for certain kinds of firearms, encouraging states to have red flag laws, and more. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jake Charles, lecturer at Duke University, executive director of the School Center for Firearms Law. With us today, looking at new potential gun legislation in Congress, what impact it could have. Some Republicans in the Senate are saying there might be an opening. Here's Pennsylvania Republican Patrick Toomey from the Senate on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday.
I think at the end of the day, this is going to come down to whether we can reach a consensus in the United States Senate. There are intensive discussions underway. It includes people who have not been engaged on this issue in the past. I certainly can't guarantee any outcome, but it feels to me like we are closer than we've been since I've been in the Senate.
Let's go back to your calls now. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Yeah, I think expanded background checks, as long as it can be done expeditiously and without too long a wait, and maybe a limitation on the size of magazines, although, you know, there's a lot of them out there now, so I don't know how good that would be, but I think it should be tried. But I don't agree with raising your age from 18 to 21. I mean, once you're an adult, you know, there's a constitutional amendment, the Second Amendment. I understand drinking age is different, but there's no constitutional right to drink or some of the other things that they have different limitations on. So I don't agree with that one.
Gotcha, Jimmy. Thanks for the call. Jimmy points us toward a couple of the other things that people are talking about there. The idea of expanded background checks, Jake, people call it a gun show loophole sometimes, places where you can buy guns without going through the normal background check. How big a window is that? How much would it mean to close it?
Right. So the federal requirement right now only requires background checks to be performed when a gun is sold by a federally licensed dealer. And so not everyone who sells guns has to get a license from the federal government to do so. Only those who are doing it as part of their livelihood with the principal motive of profit are required to get a license. And that's why it's often called the gun show loophole, because people who are kind of more casual sellers of firearms can go to gun shows and sell their firearms and not have to do background checks. But it's a little bit of a misnomer, because if a federally licensed dealer is at a gun show, they have to perform background checks. So it's more of a private sale loophole or exception. And so some states have closed this. Some states require background checks, like California, for private firearms transfers. And as the caller suggested, some of the concerns that folks have is that this would be done quickly. What some of those states have done is said, you just go to FFL, a federally licensed dealer, and you get the background check done there. And it's worth noting that at dealers, most checks are instantaneous. The background check is called the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, and most checks are completed instantly. So it would include a lot more sales than we currently have included in the background check requirement. It's really hard to say what number of sales that is, because just by their nature of being these private sales that are unlicensed, legally unlicensed, there's no kind of record of when a private sale happens. There's no national registration, no national registry of firearms. So there's no way to track which guns have been transferred in which situations. But I think it's fair to think that there would be a substantial number of transactions that would now be included in this requirement. How many of those would actually go through it is, you know, anyone's guess, but there would be a new requirement that would include a lot of sales that have so far been unregulated.
Before I go back to our callers, while we're on the topic of background checks, one idea that's been floated is, correct me if I'm getting this wrong, it's a little complicated, that for an adult making a firearm purchase, the background check in this proposed idea would include their juvenile record, which currently wouldn't be taken into consideration. Do I have that right?
I'm not actually sure about that. I haven't seen that proposal, and I'm actually not sure. I don't know. Yeah, I would think that maybe if there are sealed juvenile records, then maybe they aren't, but I'm actually not sure.
All right, I'll dig more into that one then. Let's go back to your calls now. Pete is with us in Eau Claire. Pete, hi.
Yes, sir. Say, I guess I'm not really against sensible, gun laws, but I'm not sure how effective they'll be. I am in my mid-60s, and something has changed in society since the 1970s. Gun laws have become more restrictive. I know when I've bought guns in the past, there's been a 3-day waiting period. There's background checks. Prior to the 70s, there still were semi-automatic rifles. Back at the turn of the century, some of the first hunting guns were semi-automatics. An assault rifle is really a cosmetic thing. I don't know how well some of these gun laws will work. I mean, take Chicago, for instance, some of the most restrictive gun laws in the country. 40 people were shot there last week and 10 killed. I would guess that the number of murders committed by law-abiding, sane gun owners annually is probably zero.
Pete, thanks for the call. People point towards Chicago a lot, Jake. As I understand it from some Harvard Health studies, many of the crime guns used in Chicago came from states with laxer gun control laws, many Indiana, some from here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. One of the problems with from Chicago's perspective of trying to regulate guns is that it's really easy to get guns right across the border in Indiana, which has significantly looser gun laws. And so that creates a problem for jurisdictions where, guns can freely flow into the area. The color is right that there, there is this concern among those who are opposed to gun laws about whether or not those who are intent on doing harm will just break the law anyways. I think there is some reason to doubt that that's always the case. As we saw in the Texas shooting, the perpetrator waited until his 18th birthday, at which point under federal law, he could legally go into the gun dealer and buy a weapon. I've seen some reporting that he tried to get access to a rifle earlier. If the federal law had not stood in his way, if there was no age requirement and he could have gone and got a rifle when he was 17, maybe he would have undertaken these acts earlier. If federal law had been changed to require him to be 21, maybe he would have been discouraged enough to not commit these acts at that time. Of course, it's hard to say what would have happened under a hypothetical situation. Mm-hmm. But I think we do have evidence that there are at least some people who are intent on doing harm, even intent on doing harm to others, who are dissuaded because there are legal barriers in the way. And that's to say nothing to the fact that some gun laws are actually designed to help with gun suicide rates. And we know that suicide attempts with a firearm are far more lethal than other methods of attempting suicide. And that many of the people who attempt and do not die by suicide go on to die from other causes and not from suicide. So reducing the areas where guns can enter into situation oftentimes does have the effect of saving lives.
Time for one more caller. Zoe is with us in Stevens Point. Zoe, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Zoe?
I just had an idea that I think if, because I had to do hunter safety in order to get my hunting license here in Wisconsin, and I just think that that was a good educational experience for me. It taught me how to handle guns and where to point my guns and not to shoot other people with them. So I think if it was mandatory all over the place that everybody had to have like a hunter safety education or just a gun safety education, not to shoot others, something like that, it could like deter people from wanting to harm others with guns. I'm not sure, but
Zoe, thanks for the call. Like, thanks for the call, Zoe. We don't have too much time left. Jake, has the legality of that been tested, saying, okay, if you want a gun, you have to pass some kind of safety class?
Yeah, so it hasn't, to my knowledge. I don't think even most gun rights supporters think that a training requirement itself for a certain kind of permits, at least like, you know, a concealed carry permit or a public carry permit, that a training requirement itself would violate the Second Amendment. And if the Supreme Court does what many of us observers think it might do in the upcoming case that it has right now, which is to strike down New York's concealed carry law, the restrictive version of it, then we might see more states adopting stricter training requirements. One thing that we're seeing happening in a large number of states, though, is going in the opposite direction. So states that are moving to eliminate their permit requirement altogether, which eliminates any background check requirement and eliminates any training requirement that they previously had.
Zoe, thanks for that call. And just our last few moments, Jake, how big a deal is the Supreme Court case you just mentioned?
Yeah, it has a potential to be pretty monumental. So the exact law at issue exists in about 6 to 8 other states, depending on how you count. But that accounts for about 25% of the population. But the Supreme Court might also change the way that lower courts are supposed to decide these kind of challenges in Second Amendment cases. And that has the potential to be even more monumental than just this one particular type of law. So we'll be watching to see if the court requires lower courts to look only to history and tradition, or if they allow courts to consider the effectiveness of regulation.
Jake, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Jacob Charles is Executive Director of the Center for Firearms Law at Duke University. He's with us today for a look at the prospects for new gun laws in Congress. All eyes on the Senate right now and negotiations between senators of both parties. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it was the Super Bowl of Spelling Bees. Meet a Wisconsin contestant just back from the Big Scripps National Spelling Bee and get an inside look at what it's like to spell in the spotlight. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Do you have a hobby? Something you like to do in your spare time, you know, for fun? Well, we want to hear about it. Email us now about your favorite hobby, or maybe one you're just getting back into, or one you want to start. Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org. Or make plans to call in tomorrow. From 4 to 4:30 tomorrow, we want to hear your hobby story. As you may have heard, my hobbies include board games, love them, and playing music. Pretty sure music's a hobby for me. I haven't really made money on it in the last couple of decades. And does yard work count, or do you have to like it to make it a hobby? I don't know. Let us know your hobby story. You can start the conversation now. Email centraltime@wpr.org. Hobby news you can use. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a 1,200-year-old canoe can help answer questions about the cultures that lived in Wisconsin more than a millennium ago. Two researchers joined the show to tell us how they're working to unlock those secrets. Now, the National Basketball Association celebrated the league's 75th anniversary earlier this year, but our guest says there's more to that story. He says the anniversary season is leaving out a part of professional basketball history, a big part. Before there was the NBA, or even before the two leagues that merged to create the NBA, there was the Midwest Basketball Conference. Pro basketball historian Curtis Harris joins us to uncover the Midwest's rich basketball history. Curtis is also an adjunct professor in the Department of History at American University. I talked to him earlier this year. Can you tell us about the early history of this Midwest Basketball Conference? Later, it eventually merged into the NBA.
Yeah. So, the short version of the story is in 1935, the Midwest Basketball Conference got started, and it was a professional league. But it does sound like a college operation, though. You know, a Midwest Basketball Conference. So just a couple years later, in 1937, they renamed themselves the National Basketball League. And that league went on for over a decade until 1949, when it merged with the Basketball Association of America to create the National Basketball Association. So as I always say, you do the NBL, National Basketball League, plus the BAA, the Basketball Association of America, you get the NBA, the National Basketball Association. So that's kind of the very short version of the story there.
And you make your case that the NBA with the 75th anniversary is kind of overlooking this key part of professional basketball history in the U.S. Centered in the Midwest. Why? Why are they overlooking this?
No one has ever gotten a straight answer from the NBA as to why they don't get the history correct. So they do tether their start to 1946 when that other league, the BAA, got started, and that was an East Coast league. So that was mainly in New York City, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore. Whereas the NBL, that is a Midwestern league, and it was mostly in smaller cities. So like the Oshkosh All-Stars, that was the most successful team of the NBL. But you also had the Fort Wayne Pistons, which are now the Detroit Pistons. The Minneapolis Lakers, now the Los Angeles Lakers, and several other teams like the just many other teams I can name, but that suffices. But I suspect it's the fact that the NBL was in generally smaller cities and not the glitzy, the large metro areas on the East Coast, and the NBA would like to be associated with those larger cities with its history.
Yeah, we had an Oshkosh and a Sheboygan team here in Wisconsin.
Yep.
These were pretty popular, you said, especially in Oshkosh. Some of these mid-sized cities did pretty well with these pro teams.
Yeah, the Oshkosh All-Stars are really like the, I think, the banner team for the NBL. They existed, well, they joined in 1937, and they stayed with the NBL through 1949. And if I remember right, my memory's getting a little hazy. If I remember right, they won the NBL title twice in their 12 years of operation. And they had a great center named Leroy Edwards, who was a three-time scoring champion in the NBL. They had some really successful teams in Oshkosh. But unfortunately, they were not able to join the NBA when that league got started. So they were kind of left on the sideline in 1949.
Yeah, a big part of the story you tell is that a lot of those original Midwestern teams in the NBL still survive today in different forms, in different cities. How important, like when we look at the modern NBA, the roster of teams there, how much of that comes out of this NBL?
Yeah, so this is a really important point, and why I think people should know about the NBL is that, you know, it just acknowledges the cities like Oshkosh and Fort Wayne and other Midwestern cities that fostered the pro basketball. But these were also really smart operations, and they had the best basketball talent as a league during the 1940s. So when the NBA emerged out of that merger between the two leagues, the best players and the best teams came over from the NBL. So the NBL, they were the league that had George Mikan with the Lakers. Many other guys who listeners might be less familiar with, like Bob Davies with the Rochester Royals. They powered the NBA. So like the first six NBA champions were all teams that came from the NBL. And so that just shows you the domination they had over the other league that went into creating the NBA.
Now, pro sports in this era were pretty heavily segregated, basketball no exception.
Yeah.
You write that the National Basketball League, it fits and starts, did some desegregating, though they didn't always stick with it. What did we see?
Yeah, so I think this is really important for broader American history, because we like to think of, we had segregation, and then, you know, flip a light switch, then we had integration, whereas it was a lot messier than that. So the NBL shows that kind of messiness, but it did show nonetheless progress toward desegregation. So the first black player in what becomes the NBL was Hank Williams, and he played for the Buffalo Bison back in 1935. But, you know, during World War II, team Baker, just love the name. as you might surmise, they were sponsored by Studebaker. Team was majority black. So they had 7 black players and 5 white players. Now it's like the first time in basketball history you had an integrated team that was majority black. And then in 1948-49 season, you had the New York Renaissance, a basketball team, a black basketball team that relocated to Dayton, Ohio to play in the NBL. And so they were called the Dayton Renaissance, but that was an all-black team playing in an otherwise all-white league. And that's the first time you had the only time in really professional basketball history you had an all-black team playing in a league with white players against white teams. So that just showcases kind of the integration going on in the 30s and 40s before people typically think of integration in pro basketball.
And Curtis, I got to ask, when I hear people who are very excited about the history of a pro sport, it's often baseball. You are clearly super excited about tracking the early days of basketball history. What took you there?
I come from a basketball crazy family. So my dad played basketball. My older brother and sister, they both played basketball. So I guess I had to basically get involved with basketball somehow. Like I play too, but yeah, I got into the history side of it because, as you mentioned, baseball particularly really does focus on it and champion its history, whereas I think professional basketball, which I think the NBA deserves some blame for this, doesn't do a good job of putting out its own story and getting people excited about its history. So I feel it's really important to know about, the NBL, the NBA, and these other leagues that helped foster and spread the game. Because it's just really just great stories and people to talk about when you look at professional basketball. Baseball doesn't have a monopoly on great sports stories. Basketball should be included when we talk about this stuff.
Curtis, thanks a lot for sharing this with us today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Curtis Harris is an adjunct professor of history at American University. He joined us for a closer look at pro basketball's history here in the Midwest. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about waterfalls.
Wisconsin is home to many spectacular waterfalls. And as exploring the state's natural wonders has grown in popularity, one Wisconsin listener wondered why the northern part of the state seems to have a monopoly on those waterfalls. WPR's Andrea Anderson takes you up north to find out more about the waterfall's geology and appeal.
Tom Hornung from Madison was entering a tourism-related drawing, and in order to win, he had to ask a question. After that, he came to Wisconsin with that very question. He wanted to learn why northern Wisconsin has more waterfalls than the southern part of the state. University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire hydrogeologist Dr. Sarah Vitale says most Wisconsin waterfalls are up north because there's a higher elevation. Plus, the tough igneous and metamorphic rocks in waterways with waterfalls aren't prone to erosion.
Where you have the steeper slopes that are maintained by those harder rocks, you're more likely to get waterfalls.
Vitale says the land elevation in northern Wisconsin is often more than 1,500 feet above sea level. That's about twice the elevation of much of southern Wisconsin, which sits 600 to 800 feet above sea level. Our question asker Tom from Madison speculates the impact of the Ice Age tens of thousands of years ago may have helped form northern waterfalls in Wisconsin. But Vitale says the Ice Age did not have as much of an impact as you might think.
Glaciation did a lot in terms of, scraping off what was at Earth's surface. And so any place you have a lot of glacial deposits, that's going to be easily eroded.
Southern Wisconsin does have waterfalls, including several in and around Devil's Lake State Park near Baraboo. But the vast majority are in state parks or county lands in far northern Wisconsin. A 2021 report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum says outdoor activities in Wisconsin flourished during the first year of the pandemic, including visitors to state parks. That includes Pattison State Park near Superior. That's where you'll find this waterfall. Big Manitou Falls, which is 165 feet high. It's the tallest waterfall in Wisconsin and one of the tallest in the upper Midwest. On the other side of Wisconsin is the state's most northeastern county of Marinette. It bills itself as Wisconsin's waterfall capital, boasting 16 waterfalls on public lands. Last summer, the Four Seasons Island Resort of Pembine became the first business to offer guided public tours of all the Marinette County waterfalls.
You can go to all of these for free on your own. Coming along on a trip with me, obviously I know all the roads and the routes to get to them, and I know the times of the year when the waterfalls are going to probably have a little bit more water on them and which ones you're really going to want to see.
Tour guide Steve Verdigan says last summer, dozens of people paid $65 each for a four-hour tour of many of the waterfalls in a lunch. Visiting the waterfalls also offers a chance to go bird watching or spot a white-tailed deer or black bear.
All the different berries that pop up in the wildlife that you get to see on this trip as well. The tour that someone gets at the end of May to the tour that I give in August or September are two completely different tours.
Marinette County also has more than 300 miles of ATV trails, and many of the trails have access to the waterfalls.
WPR's Andrea Anderson brought us that story. It was produced by WPR's John Davis. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin, in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, the technology of the past meets the technology of the future. Find out how 3D imaging is helping us understand a 1,200-year-old canoe found in a Wisconsin lake. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Archaeologists and engineers are working together using 3D technology to study a 1,200-year-old canoe found in Lake Mendota in November of last year. The canoe is the oldest intact boat found here in Wisconsin. Its preservation process could take years, slowing the study of this historic discovery. But with 3D scanning, scientists may be able to get a jump on that process. Jim Skibo is the Wisconsin State Archaeologist and part of the State Archaeology and Maritime Preservation Program at the Wisconsin Historical Society. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
And Lennon Rogers is Director of the Granger Engineering Design Innovation Labs at UW-Madison. Lennon, welcome to Central Time.
Great to be here.
Jim, I talked to the marine archaeologist who discovered this. Can you give us a sense of how big a deal this is, a 1,200-year-old intact canoe?
Yeah, well, it's a big deal. I mean, it's the reason we decided to take it out. It's not something we typically do with artifacts that are underwater, but being the oldest and mostly intact canoe in Wisconsin, and the fact that it had net sinkers in it, it's the only one with artifacts in it that were presumably attached to a net when it went down, and so it's evidence of early fishing with net. So it was a significant find, and when I told Christian Overland, the director of our society about it, he asked if we could take it out, and we worked with Tammy Thompson and Caitlin Zant, our maritime archaeologist, and Amy Roseborough, and we came up with a plan, and we pulled it out, and it was great success, and it turned out. In 2021, this BBC television show called Time Team voted it one of the 10 top archaeological finds in the world in 2021. So indeed a significant find.
And Lennon, can you talk about the 3D scanning technology you're using to help speed up the process of learning from this thing?
Yeah, the 3D scanner essentially takes just a high resolution scan, three-dimensional scan. So all the little details that you can barely even see with your eye, all the little markings on it that were made during the actual fabrication of the canoe, and really anything that happened since then. And it does it largely by using this laser that projects a pattern on the surface. And so we're able to save that information. And the real benefit there was that the plan was to remove the canoe out of water for a period of time. We had it out for about a day, and we're able to scan it, and then they put it back and keep it preserved underwater. So we have that high resolution scan now that we can analyze, and we have done some analysis already without needing the actual canoe out of water.
Let's talk about the people here. Jim, first of all, what do we know about the culture that probably produced this canoe?
Well, the canoe dates to 8800 approximately, which is what we call in archaeology the effigy mound culture, which was a time in Wisconsin, in the southern part of Wisconsin, where people built these effigy mounds. You could see them all around, especially the Madison area. It was a time when people, especially the Madison, the Four Lakes area, would come together during periods of the year and for burial rituals and to get together. So this was a gathering place. And the descendants of, it's hard to know who was in the canoe, because but the group that probably was here the most during this time period, and there's also a lot of movement, were the Ho-Chunk. And you know, what's interesting is that Bill Quackenbush of the Ho-Chunk Nation and a group of youths will be coming through on June 20th. They made a dugout canoe, and they're going to be going to the place where it was brought up, and then go and visit the canoe at this at our facility where it's now housed. So we had support from the tribes, support from the Ho-Chunk, and we're really, it's a project that we're doing together.
And Lennon, here you are, an engineer in 2022, using this state-of-the-art technology to look back at this state-of-the-art technology from 800. Did you wonder about the people who made this, the engineers of that day?
Yeah, that was definitely something that came to mind, and it's something that we're interested in, trying to understand the tools that were used, the process that they used to make it, and kind of what you're talking about. I mean, the lab that I oversee at UW is all about making, so it is neat to think about these people, you know, hundreds of years ago, using the tools that were available to them, the technology that they, you know, that they had access to. And here we come along years later with this high-tech scanner shining a laser on it. It was really neat.
Now, Lennon, yeah. can you paint a picture for us of what we would see if we were to look at the scan? What would it look like?
I mean, you really just see the canoe in detail. So you see pretty much every scratch, indent, the texture of the wood itself. That's what you see with the high resolution scan we did. We also used an iPhone scanner. The most recent iPhone has LiDAR and uses an approach called photogrammetry, where it takes a bunch of images and is able to back out a lot of the three-dimensional information. But the iPhone can't get that fine resolution detail that we're able to get with this other high-end scanner we use. So with the iPhone scanner, you can actually see the coloring. And so it's neat. You can see right down the center of the canoe where Jim has said that they used a burning out technique. And those kind of image, those color details you can't see with the high resolution. You can see those little minute little scratches and things with the high end, but then with the iPhone one, you can see a lot of the colors, so they kind of complement each other. And together you can really analyze, spin it around on the computer screen, zoom in, you can really take your time and analyze it.
And Jim, I tend to think of archaeology as, you know, painstakingly dusting off pottery shards and things like that. Can you talk about some of your hopes for this kind of high-tech technology to help us open new windows on the past?
Well, this is a great collaboration, and it's led to, I call it the Canoe A team, a group of interdisciplinary scholars, including Lennon, who are thinking about the canoe in a variety of different ways. We're involved in trying to get an idea of the microclimate of the area to see what the shorelines were like during that period. We were just talking off air before we came on about using the scans to look at tree rings. There are tree ring patterns to look at climate that go back to the 1600s, but not to 800. And it would be really cool if we could start building this tree ring pattern all the way back, not only to look at climate, but also it helps. It's the most accurate archaeological dating technique when you could pick up a piece of wood, find out where it is on the pattern, and and tell how old it, when the tree was cut down and when it started growing. But I think that, you know, they say Lake Mendota is the most studied lake in the world, and I'm going to try to make this the most studied canoe in the world.
That's a good place to leave it, Jim. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
And Lennon, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's great being here.
We've been talking to Jim Skibo, Wisconsin's state archaeologist, and Lennon Rogers, director of the Granger Engineering Design Innovation Labs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They talked with us about new 3D scans of this 1,200-year-old canoe found in Lake Mendota here in Wisconsin. By the way, they mentioned some scans publicly available. You can find those at our segment note. Look for it at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, funding for schools to provide lunches during the summer could expire at the end of this month unless Congress takes action to extend that funding. We'll hear about the impact of school lunch programs even in the off season, and you can let us know what's happening in your school, maybe even in your own household. And we want to hear from you about your favorite hobby or maybe one you want to take up with when and if you have more time. We'll invite you to share your story, maybe your inspiration. You can start now with an email, centraltime@wpr.org. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to a Milwaukee Public Schools literacy coach who started a YouTube show reading books out loud to kids during the pandemic. Still going on now. We'll hear her picks for the best children's books to check out this summer. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.